You're unmuted. Okay, so it's all yours. 8:31, ready to go.
Okay, everyone. Good evening again. We're picking up right where we left off, but as always, I always have to respond to things that and comments that people ask me after class, and things I check. And for those who've been with me for many semesters, know what's going on here. 95% of what I say and what you hear is off the top of my head. And therefore, sometimes, I say something and then I want to check it. Maybe it's not 100% perfect. So I like to confirm it. And then people email me. So I'm going to give a few examples of that now. We'll spend a couple minutes on this before we continue. Some interesting things, though. First of all, a couple of you wanted to know that we spoke about this Rav Abadi, who we'll get back to as well in future classes, because I have some questions in the book relating to him. It's interesting, you know, I love him. I love people like him. I love anyone who goes against the grain, anyone who is not afraid to chart their own new path. We have lots of people who come up with new ideas, but it's only theoretical. So anyone who's really, and just imagine what would it be like if he became like a Rav Moshe, and Judaism would be very different. I just the other day, I was looking in his Sefer, this book here, Or Yitzchak, Volume 1, the very first line, just to give you an example of how, and I can give a whole class on his interesting ideas. Right at the beginning, it's in Simon Vav. He talks about this idea of washing when you go to a cemetery. We all do that. I take groups in the summer. We go to the cemetery. Everyone has to wash. You have to wash. Let me show you something about the washing in a second, but he has a response in there, and he shows that the early sources, if you look at the early sources, the only people who wash are the ones who carried the mace. Other people don't. Now, granted, other people could also see that, but then they conclude, but Minhag Yisrael is you wash. But no, he concludes. He just concludes, Hanogeba mace, Tzarech Toyadav, Hahoech Vignesek Varos, ain't Tzarech. So he just says, no need to wash your hands. And and I'm going to show you something about him in a second, response to someone who asked me. It's about this washing business. I thought of this only about 15 minutes ago. I want to show you. Some of you who are with me in Central Europe will remember this. Let me share my screen here. If you go to Prague in the right after the cemetery, you go into the Chevra Kedisha building. And that was a big, important building there. To be remember, the Chevra Kedisha was a huge honor. And you see there's a series of paintings done in around 1772, which shows you when the Noda Yehuda was there. And it describes everything from what the Chevra Kedisha does, from when someone gets sick, to he dies, to burial. Let me show you, actually, this one's interesting on the left here. That's Yonah Yaitelis, if you know. He was a doctor. He was involved in smallpox inoculation in Prague. He had a son who was a big time. He was the doctor of the community. And I can't enlarge it, but I think you can see it says, the bottle he holds may depict the society's respect for science and medicine. The person who described this doesn't know what's going on here. The bottle is medicine, but on top of the bottle, you see there is a feather. What's the feather? The feather is, they used to hold the feather in front of someone, and if there's breathing, then they know he's alive. If the feather doesn't move, they know he's dead. In fact, if you go to the Halachic Organ Donor Society and listen to Rav David Feinstein, Rav David Feinstein says that his father, Moshe, told him and always said that the way you determine if someone's dead, and this is what he did in Europe, is you would hold the feather. You hold the feather. Well, this is quite significant, and this is why it's put on the Halachic Organ Donor Society website, this interview. And had they known about this picture, they would have shown it also. Because if you're brain dead, there's no breathing. So in other words, that's all they were concerned with, Ramosha says, and is if there's breathing. They didn't listen for heartbeat or anything else. But then if you go further, you go through, it's everything, it's the death, it's the burial, the eulogy, etc. And then leaving the cemetery, you know, you wash the hands, and look at this guy over here. He's wiping his hands. And these pictures are very accurate of what was happening in Prague. So you see that the current minhag we have of not washing your hand, of not drying your hands, at least didn't exist in Prague. What I want to show you now, though, is for just a 90 seconds, because a couple of people asked me this about, I mentioned this business of the silk screen safer Torah. They weren't sure what I'm talking about. So let me show you just a 90 second video on YouTube, Rav Avadi's idea. Had he been successful in this, we all could have a safer Torah. I think it's like $10,000. But he wasn't, and had Rav Avad Yosef agreed, maybe things would be different. Look, I don't think anyone anticipated that they would have permitted machine matzahs, but they did, and it changed everything, but this didn't. But I think you'll find it interesting. I have to stop sharing for a second and then restart sharing so I can give sound to you. And then I'm going to play just 90 seconds from one of his students describing this. If you want to buy it, and if you want to buy your own Megillah, they'll make it for you. But no one else assumes it's kosher. You can read Rabbi Boich and describes it. But here you can watch. This is Rabbi Yosef Tesmer from Lakewood describing it. So let's play this.
We're going to describe the silkscreen process of Sefer Torahs and Megillahs. And show details on how the ink goes from the screen onto the cloth. This orange sheet is a sample piece of silkscreen material before any preparation. The silkscreen sheet has tens of thousands of tiny holes that allow ink to be pushed through to the cloth underneath. We close up all the holes that we don't want ink to go through with a green colored film, except in the area of the letters. Those holes that represent the letters are left open to allow the ink to be placed in the screen and then pushed through onto the cloth. The film that blocks the holes of the screen is applied on top and underneath the screen. The films create a holding area for the inked letters to sit and remain until the letters are pushed onto the parchment. Silk screen is then secured onto a frame, which is then mounted onto the silk screen table. What you see now is a flexible plastic blade that acts like a large kulmus and writes many letters at once. I will now show how the blade is used to push the ink onto the cloth, similar to the tip of a kulmus pushing ink. Our blade just does many letters at once.
Okay, so very interesting. You never have a mistake in a Sefer Torah because it's all set. And you can read his 35-page shuv on why that's, because whoever says you have to do each letter individually, you can do all of them at once. But okay. Regarding, someone asked me what I meant last class when I said that Rashi's Torah is not identical to ours. I could give a few different examples, but I'm going to show you something right now. You see with your own eyes. Let's see if I can pull this up here. Here's Parshas Truma. If you do Rashi every week, Shnayim Mikra, you know this. The Pasuk says, it's in Perichav Hei, Pasuchav Beis. It says, Eis kol asher atzaveh otcha. You look down in Rashi, Rashi has ve'et kol asher atzaveh, and it says, Harei vav zo yeteiro tfeila. Rashi's saying, well, he's explaining, what's this extra vav here, ve'et? But we don't have ve'et in ours. We just have et. And if you look in Sifsei Chachamim right here on Vav, Afal Pisha Inkativ Ve'et Bevav, the Sefer Torah Shal Rashi Hayakativ Bevav. Sifsei Chachamim tells us that we don't have the Vav, but Rashi's Torah had the Vav. In fact, if you look in the Mikras Kedoshos, Ibn Ezra also explains why this Pasuk says Ve'et Koasher Atzaveh. But ours doesn't have that. And Chizkuni also, and we have manuscripts of the Torah that have this. At the end of class, someone mentioned that's the view, because we're not letter perfect, that's why we don't make the bracha. And I couldn't remember actually who said that. And it's actually, it's both the Shuvim Ava and the Chasam Sofer. I mentioned this in my Limits, my book, Limits Orthodox Theology. They do say that's the reason we don't make a bracha when we write a Sefer Torah. But even more interesting, the Shagas Aryeh, Arieh Gunzberg, says that min haTorah, there's no longer an obligation to write a Sefer Torah because we're not letter perfect. And so that's that. Final thing I want to mention. Because, I was talking just, as we say, off the top of my head, and I was trying to, we did Rav Henkin about Minhag, And I wanted, and I gave the example, I meant to say that women don't shecht, but instead I said women are not moaling today. And that's, it's not the minhag, because it's minhag. So someone said, well, the Ramah says they're not. I want to read you now what the Ramah says about this, because it turns out I was right in what I said, even though I didn't mean to say it. Here are the words of the Shulchan Aruch in Reish Samach Dalet. Hakol kasherim lamul, afilu eved isha, etc. The Shulchan Aruch says that women can be a certain moel. And then the Ramah says, v'yesh omrim yishaloti mo. There are some that say that women don't, are not moelim, v'chein noagin. And that's the minhag that we follow. So the Ramah is saying that that's the minhag. In other words, yesh omrim, but why do we do that? Because of the minhag. Now, more relevant, Rav Henkin, if you remember what Rav Henkin said, he said that women could say kiddush because it's not against the minhag, it's just that women didn't do it, but there's no positive minhag for them not to say it. The example I gave of shchita, I didn't even realize how good an example it was. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it says, this is in shchita, Siman Aleph. Hakol shochtim chadchila afilu nashim. The Shulchan Aruch says, even women can be a shochet. The Ramah says, yesh omrim again, she'en laniach nashim u'shchot, women don't shecht. Because the minhag is that they don't, and therefore that's the minhag. But if you look in the Beis Yosef, he says something, Rabbi Henkin could have quoted this. He quotes the Agur, who says that the minhag is that women don't shecht, and then he says as follows. He says, Im haya omer, if the Agur said, then that's what the Ramah's quoting, Shahayu wrote Sotli Shot Wolinichan, if you're gonna tell me that women in olden days wanted to shecht and the rabbis didn't let them, Haya Efshogamar Shi Raya, then it's a proof that the minhag is that women don't shecht. But he says, no, it's just that women didn't shecht. They had nothing to do with shechting. So the Beis Yosef says there's no minhag that women don't shecht. They just didn't shecht. For there to be a minhag they don't shecht, there would actually have to be women who wanted to, and then we say not to, and that's the minhag. And that's what Rav Henkin said about Kiddush, that there's no minhag not to say Kiddush. It's just that women didn't, and therefore it's not violating minhag Yisrael. With that, we return to, in the book, I don't know if we're going to finish Chelek Or HaChaim today, but we remember we're at Siman Chaf Hei, and I introduced you last class to the issue of inviting people for Shabbos who are going to drive, inviting them for a meal, which something which is basic for Kiruv. You can't, initiate people into what Shabbos is if they don't come, but they're living far away often. And I told you about Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's position and about Rav Moshe Feinstein's stringent position and even Rav Moshe Sternbach I mentioned. I thank Yaakov Yellen because Yaakov Yellen sent to me from this week, last week's, the YU Kollel in Toronto has a whole thing inviting Shabbat guests who will drive home. Here it is. You can see it. And they even have a biography of Rav Moshe Sternbach on the side. And at the end, they say, though a staunch anti-Zionist, Rabbi Sternbach believes there's a mitzvah, moving to the land of Israel. And they give Rav Sternbach's whole approach that since that we're trying to encourage them, it's a good thing to invite them, etc. My question is, and I raised this already, it's just a serendipitous, or Shkacha Pratis, that it's last week, why is the YU Kollel citing Rav Moshe Sternbach? Do they make a habit of citing him? Do any of us make a habit of citing him? This tshuva is cited by everyone because they like it, because it concludes what they want to hear. So I think you have to ask yourself about the consistency here. I understand that's why people do that, but I'd like the rabbis to explain why all of a sudden we're citing Rav Moshe Sternbach. Everything else he says, we're not citing, but this we like. There's other issues with Rav Moshe Sternbach. He has certain halachic rulings, which from a modern Orthodox perspective, certainly are really immoral and inappropriate. Rabbi Chaim Rappaport at the second ADA conference, maybe the first even, and these are all taped. I don't know where these tapes are. They should find them and they should put them online. Rav Chaim Rappaport gave a shiur on this topic. Is it what to do about poskim who say certain things we like, but other things we regard as positively immoral and inappropriate and unacceptable? And he dealt with Rav Moshe Klein, Rav Moshe Sternbach. Rav Moshe Klein, you like Erev also. Everyone likes his views about Erevin. So it's just ironic that I mentioned last week Rav Moshe Sternbach and I mentioned, and here you see the YU Kollel was citing him. And what about Rav Moshe? We rely on Ramosha for the Machitza. We rely on Moshe for Chol of Yisrael. We rely on Ramosha for so many. Actually, not really, because we were eating non-Chol of Yisrael before Ramosha, but still, he's the one that we quote. Aguna issues. Everyone likes to go to Ramosha, but when they don't like Ramosha's view, it's all of a sudden Ramosha, no one hears about Ramosha. I wish the rabbis would explain a little as to why all of a sudden now we don't accept Ramosha. And maybe you're going to say it. I wish I asked Rabbi Greenblatt. But what does Rabbi Greenblatt say? Rabbi Greenblatt is the Talmud Muvhak of Ramosha. And in Siman Chaf Hei, I had asked him about inviting someone to the Seder, Kiruv Rechokim, and otherwise it's not like they're going to stay home. We understand if you're going to stay home and not violate Shabbos or Yom Tov, it's one thing, but these are people who are going to be doing other things. And he says, Tovasita Sheizmato Sovas Seder, Opiatanaim Shagatavta. It's good you invited him. Now, if Rabbi Greenblatt was with us today, I'd love to ask him. And he quotes from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I would like to ask him, Rabbi Greenblatt, why in this case did you go against what your Rebbe said and go with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? And I'm assuming he would say that it's a Shas Adchak. There's no way we can be a Kari of Jews today. It's not like we live in a small community. Everyone's living far away. But it is significant that Rabbi Greenblatt, who always goes by Rav Moshe, now he's what we call a Bar Hachi. He's allowed to, on his own, decide that in certain areas, you know, he's an independent posek. But I don't think it's a question here that he thinks Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's halachic logic is superior to Rav Moshe. Rav Shlomo Zalman actually cites a Talmudic text to try to prove that this is not Lif Ne'iver. But I think this is sort of like looking at the end game here, that it's impossible to bring people close to traditional Judaism if you don't look the other way and if you don't invite them. And that's what he says. And I don't know if anyone really holds a Ramosha's position. There are certain things about Ramosha that never caught on, but make no mistake about it. It's because they were too difficult. Ramosha says no time clocks on Shabbos. Ramosha even said about no liquid soap on Shabbos. And I can tell you that his own family doesn't follow this. How do I know this? Because I asked someone in his family, very close, what then do you do? I said, based on Ramosha's tshuva, what did Ramosha say about do for hygiene on Shabbos? And he didn't tell me where Moshe did. He said he didn't know. The fact that he didn't know means that he's using liquid soap on Shabbos. This is a direct descendant of Moshe. And then he moves on in the tshuva. I asked him about Glatt Kosher. The tshuva is like 1989. 1989 is when Glatt Kosher first started moving in mainstream modern Orthodox world. It was around that time that the OU stopped giving hashgacha to Glatt Kosher restaurants, to non-Glatt Kosher meat, I'm sorry. Today you get married, you don't have the choice, Glatt or not. If you want reliable, either really reliable or in quotes reliable, it has to be Glatt by definition. But I still remember in 1989 that the caterer said to me that you can get to have regular kosher or Glatt. And it still wasn't clear whether, so I decided to do Glatt for a wedding, because some people maybe are mocked on it, but it wasn't understood it had to be Glatt. There were still restaurants that weren't Glatt, and not that long before, we would get regular hot dogs. I never really got the Hebrew National growing up. We didn't eat that, but we used to get ShopRite hot dogs. Anyone here from the New York area, that was under the Shkacha Rabbi Katz, Leon Katz from Passaic, and other ones like that. I mean, who ever heard of Glatt? The Rav Soloveitchik gave Hashkacha to, was it Morrison Schiff in Boston? So I asked Rabbi Greenblatt, what's doing with this Glatt when you were in Jerusalem? Was there Glatt in Jerusalem? He grew up in Jerusalem, in the Litvish community. And he says, Keshayiti Yelob Yerushalayim, lo achu Ashkenazim Glatt Kasher. Zen asa po be'America. There are 15 Shana, the London, Chaykam Yerushalayim. He says, this really began, and he's talking more in the Haredi world, 15 years before. So that puts it in the 70s. And then it takes about 15 years to reach into the modern Orthodox world. And in London, he says, now also in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is actually one of the only places today you can get meat that's not Glatt. The typical restaurant that people go to in Jerusalem, if it's not Mahadran, it's not Glatt kosher. A lot of people don't realize this. They don't know. They think they eat Glatt. Well, they don't eat Glatt because American meat is not really Glatt. It just means it's at a so-called higher standard, but they still accept some adhesion, some sirchot. But in Israel, if it's not Mahadran, it could be regular meat, and that's what Jews ate. So that's what the Vilna Gaon ate. That's what the Rama ate. That's what Jews ate for all time in Europe. But this is historically interesting that in Jerusalem also, because in Israel they often were more strict on these matters. And then finally, he sent me a response, and he published it in his book, and he wanted me to look at it. this is when fax machines, I guess, were first starting. The old question is, who uses a fax machine anymore? I don't know, but can you leave your fax machine on Shabbos? Leave it on. So it's Shabbos for you, but in Israel, Shabbos already ended, or maybe it's in California, and people will be sending you faxes on Shabbos. And as I wrote, and he rules that you're allowed to leave it on. What's the problem? If it's Shabbos for you and someone sends a fax for you, it's not your problem. I don't remember if he says you can actually, he says you can leave it on. Can you read the fax? So that's a different question, but you can certainly leave it on. So now we move to Simon Chaf Vav. And I'm going to take you with me on a little journey now to back to Morocco to talk about this amazing individual, just like I love, interested in Rav Abadi. Let's see, I'm interested in, let's see, Rabbi Yosef Messas, Joseph Messas, one of the most interesting and unusual post-scheme of the 20th century. One of those figures who doesn't do what other people say he has to do. He does his own thing. He's from Meknes in Morocco, a very important city. We'll get back to Meknes hopefully later today. Just like his cousin, Rav Shalom Messas, that we've spoken about. In Israel, sometimes people call him Mashash, but it's really, it's Messas. He, in the, around 1910 or so, he went to Tlemcen in Algeria, where he was a rabbi for almost, for 20 years. Tlemcen, it was, Algeria was much more secular than Morocco, because the French had come in already in the first half of the 19th century. But that's the second most important city in Algeria. One of my hobbies is to go, I wrote about this in the Sorenbog post 2 times ago. One of my hobbies is to go to the graves of the great rabbis in different countries. So I want to go to Algeria. I want to go to Algiers, and also I want to go to Tlemcen. Tlemcen has the famous Rav Ephraim Ankawa. He's the one who rode on the lion. It's even on his cemetery. It's a picture of the lion. That's the legend. I've been told by people it is not safe. The cemetery is there. It was redone. It's beautiful now. They fixed it up because when the French President Chirac came, I'm told that there is, I read that he requested it be fixed up. But I've been told by people that it's not safe as a, not just, not just a Jewish, but as a Western tourist to go to Algeria. And so one day maybe we'll go to Tlemcen. Then he returns to Meknes in the 1930s, and he remains on the Beit Din, Sgan chief rabbi, assistant chief rabbi in Meknes. And he goes to Eretz Yisrael in 1964 and becomes chief rabbi of Haifa, where he lives until his death in 1973 or 75, I forget. He is an unbelievably interesting person. He has 3 volumes of collected letters full of history and poetry and all sorts of great stuff. He has a number of volume of tshuvot, well, 2 volumes, but then he has responsa in different volumes. He has drashot. He was one of the most beloved rabbis of Morocco, a poet, a preacher. And we did classes on him. You can go to the Torah in Motion website. They're not on YouTube like these, but you can learn about him. He gave a couple interesting rulings. The one dealing with women's head covering, I'll come back to later, because there's a very long responsum of Rabbi Moshe Malka, who we mentioned. And I will deal with what Rav Shalom Messas says about that as well, with Simon Chavav. But right now, I want to talk about the first half of the tshuva of Rav Shalom Messas. If you recall Rav Shalom Messas, that's the great chief rabbi of Jerusalem. We're going to hear more about him as well. But let me get, so I want to read you something now to show you what I asked Rav Shalom Messas. I just have to read you this. It's from his tshuvot, his responsa. The responsa, you can see it on HebrewBooks.org. I don't actually, volume 1 is on. I don't know volume 2. But you can see it on Otzer Chachma elsewhere. It's called Mayim Chaim. This is Chayel Bar Chaim Simon Kuf Yud. And I'm not going to read it in Hebrew. I'm just going to translate it. It's just 2 paragraphs. And I think you'll see how shocking this is. And he just says it without, just like Rav Abadi, just says it. The question he was asked is about a hotel. Do you have to, and you have a hotel, everyone has a separate room, but in the middle there's a chatzer, there's a public place. Do you need an Erev? Erev chatzeros. Erev chatzeros, if you have a courtyard and a few people live in it and you want to carry in the middle of the courtyard, you need to have an Erev chatzeros so everyone can carry there. So that was the question. The answer is him as follows. Why are you asking about a hotel? Ask about all the chatzerot in the city. Because that's, if you know Morocco, they would have in many of the areas, you go in and then there's a courtyard in the middle and the houses, the different apartments are on all different sides. And he says, in all the chaserot in the city, we're talking in Meknes or Tangier, the question is Tangier, but everywhere. Remember, this is they've already left Mela. When they were in the Mela and it was closed, then there was an Eruv. But then they moved in later, especially after World War II. This is from 1955, or Mesasas Tshuva. They moved to the French, the new city. And he's saying that. So why are you asking? He's saying, in all the chatzera we have in the city, people are carrying without an Eruv. And then he says, why? He doesn't say that they're sinners or anything like that. Hatam Pashut, he says the reason is simple. The sages do not require an Erev in a chatzer, which has many houses, unless the chatzer, the courtyard, goes into a Rishut HaRabin. Because, and this is true, this is what the Poskim, the Rishonim all say, because if you're in the chatzer, you might walk out into the Rishut HaRabin and carry. And therefore, we make an Erev, so you know that this is a special place, but biblically, and you can carry inside the courtyard, but you can't go out. But biblically, you're allowed to carry in the chutzner. And then it says, so the Omru, and you'll say, just like it's mutter to carry between these houses, which it is, according to Torah law, so too it's mutter to carry outside the chutzner, and that's also in the Torah. So therefore, they made an Eruv chutzerot. So you have to make, you can't carry in a chutzner unless you have an Eruv. And then you'll know that here you can carry, you can't carry in Rishut HaRabim. And then it says, he quotes in the Torah. Listen to this. I'll read in Hebrew and then read it to English. The im kein bizman hazeh she'en lan Rishut HaRabim ki Rishut HaRabim hi dafka rechov shemahalchin bo shishim ribo b'nei adam b'chol yom. He says, in our day and age, when we don't have Rishut HaRabim, because for Rishut HaRabim, you need 600,000 people walking every day. And that's a shita. There is a shita that today we don't have any Rishut HaRabim, which means the whole concept of Rishut HaRabim is really only theoretical. The Chol HaRachovot Atzlenu Him Rak Karmelit, Shasura Him Midirabanan, all the streets we have are only a Karmelit. All of our areas that where we live, unless maybe you live in the middle of Manhattan or something, it's just a Karmelit. It's only rabbinic prohibition to carry. Listen to this. V'lachein kol chatzerot p'turim min ha'erev. He says that all chatzerot are putter from an erev. She'ein kan taot b'isur d'oraita l'asot geder v'siag v'zeh pashut. He says, since outside the chatzer, there's no more Rishut HaRabim. The whole reason you had to make an erev on the chatzer was because of the fear that you carry into the Rishut HaRabim. But since there is no more Rishut HaRabim outside, it's only a karmelit, therefore there's no obligation to do an erev chatzerot. This is unbelievable for the simple reason that you didn't have Rishut HaRabim in medieval times either. And yet no Rishon says that you don't need to make you can do without an Erev Chatzerot. It's Rav Shalom Mesas, in his tshuva to me, I asked him, did anyone rely on this in Morocco? And he says, Chochmei Ador Chokulav Bazev, Lo Hodulo, they rejected it. And he says he has a long tshuva of like 25 pages in his volume Tevuot HaShemesh. And Rav Mesas says this is Bal Yaral Bal Yamatzeh. That this is not seen. Not no one ever heard of something like this. If this is an unbelievable chiddush saying you don't need to do an Erev Chatzeros at all. Who ever heard of such a thing? It's in the Rambam. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. And they also didn't have Rishut HaRabim according to him. So. And yet this is not a reform rabbi. This is a rabbi who comes out of the traditional Moroccan rabbinate, but just comes up with some very, very interesting ideas. And this is one of them. It's even crazier. He has another tshuva, which they kept under wraps for 75 years. They kept under wraps. We know about it because it's quoted. It just was published last year in the responsa of his colleague in the rabbinate, Rav Afal Toledano of Meknes, Rav Mesas goes even further. He doesn't think you need an Erev at all. After all, Erev Chatzeres is really not much different than an Erev around the city. He doesn't believe, here is a, not just an Orthodox rabbi, this is the rabbi of, he couldn't be elected chief rabbi today, Haifa, but he was the chief rabbi of Haifa, who held halacha l'maisa that today you do not need an Erev. you can carry without it. And that's if you look at Rav Shalom Masas's volume of responsa, Tevuot Shemesh, or Chaim Siman Samachay, he has 30 pages, 25, 30 pages, rejecting this. It's an unbelievable ruling, and you got to ask yourself, what type of posek is this that can come up with such interesting ideas and not be bound by convention? The other responsum is, which I'll come back to it later, deals with his view on women's hair covering. That everyone knows about, his position on married women not being obligated to cover their hair. But Rav Masas rejects that, but I'll come back to that later because we have to see what Rav Moshe Malka says about it. But that is Siman Chaf Vav. And despite this crazy ruling, and I call it crazy because no one ever said this before, and it's one thing to come up with new ideas like Rav Abadi does based on Rishonim, but this is completely his own idea without any sources. He still, to this day, is one of the great Moroccan rabbis, given enormous respect with all the titles, one of the Gedolim of Morocco. Everyone in Morocco, from Morocco, knows Rav Yosef Masas. The next tshuva, Chav Zion, is written to me. Also, I asked another rabbi. His name was Rav Yosef Sharbit. This I don't like. Here's a Moroccan rabbi who was in Casablanca, elsewhere. He comes to, the Sephardic rabbis felt that when they came to Eretz Yisrael, they had to look like an Ashkenazi. So look at him. No one in Morocco ever dressed like this. Why do the Moroccan rabbis need to dress this way? But okay, that's, I think there was a lot of feeling second best. So they had to dress. So he became the chief rabbi of Ashkelon. He died in 2016. He was on the Moetzet Rabbanut HaRashit. In Morocco, he was not a rav of a city. He was a sofer beit din. In Morocco, you had, in all the cities, you had a chief rabbi and a beit din, and then you had what's called a sofer beit din. And the sofer beit din, his job was to, there was a few of them, it wasn't just to write the gittin and everything, it also was, they did all the weddings. In Morocco, this, you could not have a Rosh Yeshiva or a friend or anyone do your wedding. The wedding had to be done, and this was by French rules, government rules, it had to be done by the sofer beit din. But they were big talmidei chachamim as well, not at the level of rabbanim, of the rabbis of the city. But so he became, though, in Israel, the chief rabbi of Ashkelon, and he wrote a number of volumes of tshuvot. The number 27 in my book, as it says, was printed, his tshuvot to me, and the response of Orchot Yosher. His response, although I don't think it's disrespectful to say they don't rise to the level of many others. There's no originality. He's just citing sources. And I asked him the same question, and he doesn't really, he just writes a tshuva explaining the laws of Erev Chatzerot. He doesn't answer my question, which was, Rav Yosef Masas holds you don't need an Erev Chatzerot. So what to say about that? He doesn't really answer it. But if you're interested in just the basic sources of an Erev Chatzer, but look how he refers to him, Hagaon, Kvon Marina Rav, Yosef Masas, Zatzal, but he doesn't deal with the real issue, which is, what to say about this great rabbi who holds you don't need an Erev. That's Siman Chav Zion. Siman Chav Ches. That's just a small, I'll show you two things about this. First of all, it's this is the rabbi who wrote to me. Because I wrote to him. His name is, as you see here, Rav Shmuel Eliezer Stern. He's the Rav of the Rosh Yeshiva of what they call Chug Chasam Sofer. Even though he himself, as I recall, is from a Hasidic background, the Chasam Sofer people are the ones from Hungary who are not Hasidim, what they call the Ashkenazim, the Davin Nusach Ashkenaz. I was looking for something in the Chasam Sofer, and I couldn't find it. So I wrote to him, and he told me where it was. But what I want to call attention to in this tshuva, I'm going to show you it, because it, let me stop the share. Well, here's the book. And look at how he addresses me. Can you see it there? I've underlined it. Kavod harav agon ha-mefuar v'chulei v'aynel shofi yoshi. If anyone wants to know, is good a proof that all these fancy titles that people get, everyone's Harav Agon, Agon Harav, Agon Amiti, all this stuff, you can throw almost all of them out the window. He doesn't know me from Adam. I just wrote him a letter asking him a question since he's next from the Chasam Sofer. But now it's convention. He has to reply, Harav HaGon HaMafawar. So when you see all these titles, unless you know who the person is, today every Rav is a Gon, and every Gon is a Gon Amiti. And in my new Sfarim blog post today, which just came out today, you can look at it. I quote Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg as saying that for the, he says about the Aguda, every rabbi who joins them, they turn him into a great Gon. And I'll go further. I say that every Askan, every guy who is involved in, they call him Askanim, he's all of a sudden a rabbi. They give all these Askanim. People who are not rabbis, but everyone's a rabbi, and every rabbi is a Gon. And if you need any more proof for it, it's the fact that I'm being called Harav HaGaon. It's in the introduction, I say that I'm keeping all these titles. Even though I thought of taking them out, but you know, the half of them have already been published in books, because it goes to show you that the meaninglessness of all these titles, that these titles used to mean something. So then all of a sudden, Maran, when HaGaon was used by everyone, the Maran was special. But now everyone's Maran. So you need to come up with, constantly have to come up with new titles. The next tshuva is from Rav Herschel Schechter. And this also, we need a bit of a background. I have tshuva going back from Rav Herschel going into 1984. 85 will be the earliest one. So we're talking a long time. There's an amazing letter from the first show in the book, which is not a tshuva. Even those who are not such great fans of Herschel Schechter, I think when you hear this tshuva, what he wrote to me, I think you'll be very, very impressed. Well, let me tell you about what's going on here. The title is Achilo B'Tisha B'Av, Eating on Tisha B'Av, the Shita of Reb Chaim of Brisk regarding fast days, and deciding halacha against the Shulchan Aruch. So let me tell you what's going on here. And if you look in Rav Herschel Schechter's book, Nefesh HaRav, that's really the book, I still think that's probably his greatest. He wrote two or more about the Rav, but Nefesh HaRav really made a big impact. And it's really a wonderful book. Obviously, it has his own outlook, Herschel's outlook. I mean, he has a whole I don't know, first 50 pages is, you know, about the Rav. And he has all sorts of stuff there, you know, about the Rav. Can Golda Meir be, you know, what he said when Golda Meir was elected prime minister? Can we have a woman prime minister? Well, he has a whole thing. And yet there's nothing in there about the Rav's position, which was stated on numerous occasions, including in front of an RCA convention of like hundreds and hundreds of people, that to give back land, you can give back land in Eretz Yisrael for the sake of peace. So you'd think that, you know, if you're presenting from Soul Matrix views, that has to be included as well. So I've never asked Rav Schechter why he didn't include that, but I think we understand that he has his own positions on certain areas. Maybe he didn't want to mention it because he didn't want to dispute with him, whatever. But it's an enormously valuable book, Nefesh HaRav. And if you look on page 261 and 262, he says, I'm just going to read you a translation of this. He says, when the parents of Rabbeinu, that's Rav Soloveitchik, married, Reb Chaim sent a letter, I guess, to the Kala, Pesha. Pesha, she was the daughter of Elia Prisoner, that she doesn't have to fast on the day of, the Minhag Yisrael is to fast on the day of the wedding. He said to her, don't fast on the day of the wedding. Because, incidentally, we know that she said, she replied back to him, that it's okay, I can, my father's my rabbi, I can ask my father. Her father was Elia Prisoner, unbelievable, that will be so. So why did Reb Chaim say that? Because Reb Chaim held that everyone today has the status of a cholah she'ein bo sakana, that is someone who's ill, but you're not ill, deathly ill, but you're just ill. And therefore, cholah she'ein bo sakana ein tzarech lisanos b'shar taniyos. You don't need to fast. A cholah she'ein bo sakana, you don't need to fast. Listen to this. Va'afilu b'tisha b'av, k'dasa machaber b'av ne'ezer, chutz me'yom ha'kipurim. Rav Schechter tells us here that Rav Chaim held that today no one needs to fast except for an Yom Kippur. Because we all have the status of a cholesh, yesh bo sakana, ein bo sakana. We all have the status of someone who's ill, even if we're not deathly ill, but we're ill, and that could turn into things. And therefore, Reb Chaim held You don't need to fast on Tisha B'Av. How does he know this? He says, Kach Shamati. It's another issue with the Nefesh HaRav. How reliable are the things that that he heard as opposed to being written? But there's a whole tradition, I'll get into it, with the briskers on fasting. So that in and of itself, by the way, is a very radical idea from Reb Chaim. And then he says, nevertheless, that Rabbeinu, Rav Soloveitchik, would fast on all the fast days, even on Yortzeitz. Now, this is a radical view of Reb Chaim, because I don't know anyone else who's ever stated that other than Yom Kippur, there's no longer an obligation to fast, including on Tisha B'Av. We know that people are more liberal on the other fast days. And when I was in Morocco some winter, we were there by mistake. It turned out to be fine, but we didn't realize it on Asara B'Tevis. But it turned out it was great. Some of you listening were probably with us, but there's a big Talmud Chacham who was on our trip, and he told me about this Shita that you only fast until Mincha. You know, so there's, but Tisha B'Av is regarded as much more stringent. Even women in the Haredi world, as far as I know, generally fast on Tisha B'Av, even if not on the other fast days. And there's no real source for the report. So I spoke to Rav Schachter about this. In fact, at the beginning of his tshuva, I asked him, could I quote him? He says to me, I wrote him, what I'm going to tell you now, I wasn't sure, you know, if I could speak publicly about it. I wrote about this. So I asked him, could I? And he says, you can. Because he comes to my town, West Orange, New Jersey, about every 3 months. He comes to give these shiurim, maybe 5 times a year. So I spoke to him once there about this business that he has with Reb Chaim, not holding that you have to fast. And he said to me that, and when he says it, it's not just like, just shamati. Not everything he says, kach shamati, is 100% correct. There's some things that aren't, but this is more halachically oriented. Even if it's not true, the fact that Schachter thinks it could be true, it shows you there's this tradition among the briskers, and I'll tell you some other stuff about the briskers in a minute. So he said that the story is that Reb Chaim left a will stating that no one should fast on Tisha B'Av. But this, as far as I know, it doesn't survive. It's who knows if there's any truth to it. Look, I'm skeptical, because if Reb Chaim really felt this, he could have announced to his community. Why didn't he get up and announce to everyone, you don't need to fast? But then it gets even more curious, because Rav Schachter told me, I asked him, you know, where did he get this from? That, you know, this business of Reb Chaim not fasting and the whole brisker tradition. And in his letter to me, he writes that he heard it from Professor Cohen, who's from the Annenberg Institute in Philadelphia, who heard it from Rav Simcha Sheps, because he learned with Rav Simcha Sheps at Torah Vadas. I called Professor Cohen, and Professor Cohen said that Rav Schachter doesn't have it exactly correct. He didn't hear it from Simcha Sheps. He heard it from Aaron Schreiber. Aaron Schreiber heard it from Simcha Sheps. So Professor Aaron Schreiber, who passed away a number of years ago, was someone I knew, and I assume he's direct descendant of the Chasam Sofer. He has an article. His son, I think his name is Daniel, has published a number of volumes called Noraos Harav. And Daniel knows the story I'm going to tell you. So I called up Aaron Schreiber. Rav Simcha Sheps was a Talmud of the Brisker Rav. And the story I heard is really not exactly Rav Schachter says, but it's a similar thing. So I think there's some confusion there, that Rav Simcha Sheps, who was a Talmud of the Brisker Rav in Brisk, that one day on the, not Tisha B'Av, Shivasar B'Tammuz, he visited the Brisker Rav, he entered his home, and he found him at the table eating on Shivasar B'Tammuz. That's not the story that Rav Schachter tells, that Rav Chaim held that today you're not, no one has to fast, even on Tisha B'Av. But it's an interesting report. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, however, said, someone asked him about this as well, because there's another report that the Brisker Rav ate on Tisha B'Av, and Rav Aaron said that's someone I know asked Rav Aaron, that was because he was ill. In the story of Rav Simcha Sheps, the whole family was sitting around the table. Now, does that mean they were all eating? I don't know. And Robert said it was for a medical reason. I wrote all this in the swearing blog. You look in the comments, and someone there from who studied in Brisk, I was shocked, said that none of this surprises him, and that from his experience in Brisk, he doesn't think that if you'd eat on Tisha B'Av, you said you're a little weak, they wouldn't care. So if anyone here studied in Brisk, you can tell me about it. It's hard to say exactly get to the bottom of this, because these are the sort of rulings that are passed, you know, from person to person, not written down. The Briskers have always been very careful on health matters. Then he says, perhaps this is the reason, Rav Schachter says, that Rav Chaim wanted his children to eat on the other fast days, because of a Maisa Shirito, an event that occurred with him. And I haven't yet asked Rav Schachter what that event was. Any of you can ask him. There's some event that occurred with Rav Chaim, but once again, are these true stories or not, that he didn't want? It says, "Why Tamagavar Sharatz Rav Chaim Shiotzav Chalatzav Yochlu B'Sharataniyos." When he says eat on the other fast days, he means even eat on Tisha B'Av. But my question to Rav Schachter was, how could Reb Chaim go against the Shulchan Aruch this way? I think this is very radical. Now, it's true, Reb Chaim didn't necessarily feel bound to the Shulchan Aruch. The same issue we're speaking about, that if Yom Kippur, if you feel like you need to eat, the Shulchan Aruch holds you eat Pachos Kashir a little bit every couple minutes, whatever the Shir is. Reb Chaim held no. Reb Chaim held if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, you eat regular. So that's against the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Schachter replied to me, but this is much more significant, I think. You don't have to eat on fast on Tisha B'Av. Rav Schachter replies, "Uvichal benogel psikat halachot neged Shulchan Aruch, regarding the general matter of deciding halacha against the Shulchan Aruch, see what I wrote in Nefesh HaRav in the name of the Gra." And if you look in Nefesh HaRav, page 63, Rav Schachter says as follows. He says, "It is known what the Gra says," and this is mentioned by Rav Chaim of Volozhin and Chut HaMashuach, "She'im chacham biror et halacha," if a sage, we're talking about a post Shulchan Aruch sage, you know, determine the halacha, v'yatzal olamaskan al laharos neged p'sach Shulchan Aruch, and his ruling is to go against the Shulchan Aruch, v'afal pikein who posek at divrei Shulchan Aruch, and nevertheless, even though he thinks the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, he decides like the Shulchan Aruch, hareza over b'lav delotisa panim mishpat. He's violated the commandment of not following the way you're supposed to in your rulings, but instead just going along with the other people. Every Dayan is supposed to follow their conscience. Now, that's true. That's what the Gra said. But the Gra was the Gra, and he could disagree. Ramosha Feinstein says that if you conclude based on your own Svara, you can even go against Rishonim if you want. However, not the Shulchan Aruch, because the Shulchan Aruch has been accepted. It's like the Talmud almost, it's Mekubal. This is all, I think, just general trends. Most people assume the Shulchan Aruch, when we say the Shulchan Aruch, I mean the Shulchan Aruch in the commentaries, are binding. But others, you have Reb Chaim, the Rugachover, the Gra, they didn't feel bound to the Shulchan Aruch. So Rav Schachter, I mean, he's quoting what the Gra says, and Reb Chaim held similarly. He's telling me that you're not bound by the Shulchan Aruch if you disagree. I don't think anyone today would say that even if they're a great posek, that I'm going to disagree with the Shulchan Aruch. You might disagree if you find the Vilna Gaon, but just if there's no support you can get to simply say, well, I don't accept the Shulchan Aruch. And there are times when there's good reason to disagree with the Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg mentions, the Shulchan Aruch says, he's, in the Beis Yosef, he's going to decide halacha based on the three big sources, the Rush, the Riff, and the Rambam, go by the majority. There are some times when he doesn't follow that. He'll go by one. So therefore, Rabbi Weinberg deals with a case where the Riff and the Rambam say one thing, the Rush says something else, and the Shulchan Aruch follows the Rush. And Rabbi Chaim Weinberg says that this is wrong. The halacha should be the other way. It should be the Riff and the Rambam. But even then, Rabbi Weinberg says, who am I to go against the Shulchan Aruch? He says, if the Vilna Gaon disagreed, then I can go with the Vilna Gaon, but the Vilna Gaon agreed with the Shulchan Aruch. So even when you think you have a good source, who can go against the Shulchan Aruch? I think this is the real difference between the Orthodox and the halachic egalitarians. If you see this new halachic egalitarianism, Rabbi Ethan Tucker, he knows a lot, he has smicha from the chief rabbinate, they saw how conservative Judaism really collapsed and never really created a movement. So they wanted to create the real conservative Jews. They don't even call themselves conservative, as far as I know. So they opened up Machon Hadar, and these are people who are absolutely committed to halacha, but they just do it a little different. Like, there's no machitza. Well, so he has a tshuva there about egalitarianism. And you have a problem here, because how can you be a egalitarian when the Shulchan Aruch says that only men count in the minyan? Well, if you read Ethan Tucker's tshuva, you'll see how, why he is not in the Orthodox fold, because the Shulchan Aruch is like all the other sources that in certain circumstances you can push them aside in favor of others. Like, we do that with the Chasam Sofer, we'll do that even with the Vilna Gaon, but the Orthodox won't do that with the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch accepted by everyone. That's why the Shulchan Aruch is special. We have time for another one. Okay. The next tshuva is from Rabbi Greenblatt. This is Simon Lamed. A few different issues are discussed, putting a sukkah on a fire escape, other things. I'm more interested in the, what he calls, Derech Psikat Halacha, how to decide halacha. And that's on page Nun Dalid, because I wrote to him about Besamim Rosh. He cited this work, Besamim Rosh, which is this forgery, this 18th century forgery by Rabbi Shaul Berlin, which there's different ways to understand what was going on there. I believe that this was a proto-reform work, that Shaul Berlin comes from the greatest rabbinic families, related to all the big Gedolim, he's really a genius. He forged this work. Here it is, actually. It was reprinted in Jerusalem in 1984. With a commentary by someone who doesn't know what's forged. And you have all sorts of crazy stuff in there, the things that he permits. But Rav Avadya Yosef has a tshuva in which he says that we can't rely on the Besamim Rosh for halachic decisions. Obviously, this is a forger, the heretic, let's say, writing this work to undermine traditional Judaism, at least that's how I see it. Rabbi Rekefet, I mentioned this before, gave about 10 classes on the Besamim Rosh, quite interesting classes, but he says, this has got to be one of the craziest things, he says that Shaul Berlin is a modern Orthodox Jew, and since I wasn't YU, he had to sort of create, underhandedly try to bring in YU ideas, but it's not about that at all. He's bringing in reformist ideas, anti-halachic ideas. It's not about Torah Mada. In the 18th century, it's not about creating, modern orthodoxy in the closed ghetto. He's undermining traditional Judaism and halacha. And even when he's machmir, he undermines it. Like, he has a tshuva there where he quotes Rabbeinu Tam as saying that you can drink non-kosher wine, non-Jewish wine. Because why can't you drink non-Jewish wine? Because it's idolatrous. And Rabbeinu Tam says, well, we see it's not... they don't use it for idolatry anymore. I don't know how you could say that if they use it in the church. And then he has the tshuva, though, where the other rabbis reject Rabbeinu Tam. And the other rabbis reject Rabbeinu Tam by saying, well, who knows? Maybe in the future they'll return to using wine for idolatrous purposes. So the tshuva on the face of it is a machmir tshuva. Rabbeinu Tam is quoted, which is a phony quotation, as permitting non-kosher wine, non-Jewish wine. But the other rabbis say, no, we can't permit it because in the future they might return to using it for idolatry. So obviously then in the 18th century, someone could look around and say, we're 500 years since Rabbeinu Tam. They haven't changed at all. So even though the tshuva is machmir, it opens up the gate to permit non-Jewish wine. So it's a complete reformist text. Rav Avadya Yosef says you can use the arguments in the Besamim Rosh, not the authority of the individual, but the argument. So if Besamim Rosh comes up with a good argument, you can use that argument. You're not using it based on the authority of the person. You're using it on the quality of the argument. So you can learn Besamim Rosh. Also, there's a big commentary on it, which Rashal Berlin wrote, called Kasid Harsana. Those people in Paul Shaviv and from London, I gather, you can go in the old Jewish cemetery in the East End, the oldest of all the Jewish cemeteries, you can go see Shaul Berlin's grave. I got them to open it up for me special a few years ago, and you can see pictures of it online. For some reason, although he was basically thrown out of the rabbinic world in Europe, in London he was able to at least live as a part of the community. I found this astonishing. Chacham Avad Yosef would say this, that we should use the work for the arguments. Now I understand better what he was saying, that all Rav Avad Yosef is saying is that, you know, we can use arguments from anyone. A non-Jew can come up with a good argument. But at the time, this really bothered me. And I wrote to Rabbi Greenblatt, and I developed, I looked at my letter before to him, that I developed the whole idea that to decide halacha, you can't have a computer. It's not just the knowledge. It's also the individual. And just because you come up with good ideas, that's you need the imprimatur. You need the imprimatur of a sage. This is really, I think, the difference between more liberal orthodoxy, especially open orthodoxy, and more traditional orthodoxy. And that more liberal orthodoxy, my sense is that if you come up with a good argument and you're a rabbi, it's enough, basically. I think traditionally it's been on the big things, you really needed the imprimatur of a sage, and he agreed with me, Barry Greenblatt. Ani maskim itcha, tzar sheyeh posik mekubal v'lo maspik mekorot. It's not enough just to have mekorot. You can find all sorts of sources, but you need someone with the authority to be the makeh bepatish to say, well, we're going to adopt these sources. And then Rabbi Greenblatt says, acheret kol achad yifsok, because otherwise everyone could paskin. Tzar sheyeh rav mekubal k'posik. Umashe katafta hu hakol nachon l'amita shel Torah. A nice thing he said. He said, what I said is correct according to the Amita Shel Torah. I believe that. I wasn't just saying that. That it's not just enough to have the argument. You need to have the authority figure to adopt the argument. Otherwise, it's really hefker, because then anyone can come up with arguments. And this really was the issue about the partnership in Yemen. You had Rabbi Mendel Shapiro, who really no one had heard of him before, Orthodox rabbi though. This is before Sperber got involved. Sperber gave it a little more gravitas, but Mendel Shapiro wrote an article in which he argued, and his argument could be 100% perfect, that women can lead certain parts of davening, they can get aliyahs and all that. And as soon as that article appeared in the Eidah Journal, immediately, all of a sudden, now people said, okay, now we have a heter, we have permission. I don't know. Since when does halacha work that way? Then just because one rabbi, any rabbi, publish an article, all of a sudden now you can change practice of longstanding. And but that was my position. And again, it changed a little because Rabbi Sperber has more gravitas. That's the tshuva. Time flies already. We're at 9:29. So what I can tell you is that when we meet again, we're going to be finishing up Or HaChaim. I'm going to take you to Morocco. No, sorry, to Yemen. We're going to move to Yemen. And believe it or not, you're going to hear about a tshuva that was inspired. Wait till you hear how. By none other than, where is it, than this man, Solomon Freehoff. If you don't know who Solomon Freehoff is, stay tuned. Fascinating person, had the largest private collection of responses, they say, in the world. You'll hear a tshuva, and then we're going to move from Yemen, and all about Yemen, the Dardaim, and the Ikshim, the whole of the dispute there, and then we're going to move into Morocco, and we'll finish up Or HaChaim with a tshuva by this individual. Does anyone know who Rav Rafael Deluya is? If you paid attention recently, you'll know. He's the author of that book you see in the middle, Zocher Britavo. He's one of the ones who signed the Zoom tshuva for having Passover Seders by Zoom. But my question to him was had nothing to do with it, obviously. It's from... It goes back to 2005. So we will end here, and I will look. I wasn't even looking at the questions. Getting back to what I just said about Simon Roche, I think the Bessamim, I agree with Rav Vagina. I don't, you know, that there's nothing wrong with signing the Bessamim Roche. If he has a good argument, good logic, but you have to know that it's a forged text. At the time, though, it bothered me that for an achuva we'd be citing, but you know, these sources. Okay, let me get to the comments here. Thank you all for, I thought that tonight was going to be the last time, but it turns out we're going to keep going. Ellen, someone texted me another Maverick, but Paul Shalaviv, but I'm thinking of Gadol Yisrael. And the Maverick you mentioned, Paul, actually cites Rav Masas, what I just mentioned, Halacha L'maisa. Ellen says she remembers times when we didn't wash after funerals or going to the cemetery. Look, I go to cemeteries all the time. Sometimes there's no water. I go to these old cemeteries I track down in Europe and North Africa. They don't always have water there. And it's not a halacha, it's a minhag. But so it's not the biggest deal. But I don't remember, I'm younger, but I don't remember not, if you have the water, not doing it. But just so you know, if Rav Abadi holds, it's only, he quotes the Gaonim, it's if you touch them. But simply walking in the cemetery, the Ma'aril, he quotes, does say you wash by going in the cemetery. But he says that's not the mainstream view. You have to ask someone, why would you wash when you go in the cemetery? If you start looking at some of the reasons, maybe you'll find it strange and you won't want to. I mean, about tumah in the air and all sorts of things like that. Is it minhag Yisrael for kohanim to wash after attending a funeral, despite their refrain from coming with informal to the graves and the mate? I don't know. I'm not a kohen. We have to ask a kohen. I'm sure we have a kohen here who has. I would assume yes, because they're still in a cemetery. I don't know. Shmuley says if Ramosha held when going from a funeral to the base medrash, you don't have to wash their hands. I'd love to know why. Does a rabbi permit a woman to perform the silk screen process? That would go, get to the issue, can a woman be a soferet? Can a woman write a Sefer Torah? We assume she doesn't write a Sefer Torah. Correct? Someone correct me if I'm wrong. We assume that she doesn't have the same chiyuv, and therefore she doesn't. You can read Rabbi Bleich, the whole, they reject. Even if Rav Abadi was 100% correct, they still wouldn't accept it because it's too much of a change. No one's going to change procedure like this, I think. Although if Rav Abadi permitted it, Rav Abadi came to YU. This was like the last straw to really throw him out of Haredi society, but he came to YU, Rav Schechter was there, and he gave a whole presentation. They did the whole thing there. Someone mentioned all the Sofri would be out of business. Okay, that's, I don't know if that's necessarily a concern. During the dispute over Ann Matzah, Rav Shlomo Kluger, who was one of the big opponents of Machine Matzah, he said that we can't, you know, the women who, they make their, a bit of a parnasa for a month before Pesach by working to make the matzahs, and we'll take this away from them. So we have to usher it. So the Shol Lameshi, Rostel Yosef Shal Nathanson replied that, you know, it's unfortunate that the women might lose some income, but you know, that doesn't make it kosher or not kosher. We're not going to say you can't, what is it, social engineering here, that we're going to introduce this form of socialism. That's not, if halacha says that you can do the machine matzah, we can't say no because of someone's parnasa. Using that logic, we could have said none of us should be able to have computers because the typewriter businesses all went out of business. There used to be guys in Manhattan who, before fax machines, before email, obviously, you'd give them papers and they'd bike down the street and, you know, get your documents to the other side of Manhattan within an hour. So those people had to find. Time moves on. Chaim Malks, Rav Yisrael Drazen has noted that hand washing must prevent the shadim of the cemetery from following you home. Well, that's what I just mentioned a few minutes ago, that everyone is so mocking on washing hands. If you learn some of the reasons, maybe you wouldn't be so mockbid. They speak about tumah, they shadim, all sorts of things like this. Now, it's true that other reasons have been given. A lot of these reasons that you look in early sources that have to do with demons, later people gave different reasons. So it doesn't mean we're Negelwasser, for instance, the whole idea of Negelwasser in the morning, three times. Washing three times is only because of the Ruach Ra, the Shadim. I asked Rav Henkin once, Yerutzel Henkin, if you don't believe in Shadim, do you have to wash three times? He didn't think so. But others might say, yeah, you know, you give a different reason. Ellen says, a friend of mine had the idea to make a template for mezuzot. He asked Rav Moshe, he said he shouldn't do it. Mezuzot is a different issue. Rav Abadi does not do for mezuzah. Apparently, there's a different issue of mezuzah. It has to be literally word for word, whereas for Sifrei Torah and Megillah, you have to look in the tshuva. I forget the details. There, it's not that issue. There was a post-game even. I think Rav Shmuel Abuham in Venice, when the printing press was just invented, they were posting with what you could do with Sefer Torah from the printing press. Do any manuscripts have the Vav and Shemot as in Rashi's commentary? Yes, we have Torah manuscripts that have the Vav as well. So it's not just in Rashi and Ibn Ezra and Chizkuni. We actually have manuscripts of the Torah that have it. Yes, Paul Shaviv mentions Biberi Levi, which we spoke about last week, the Keter. Well, we don't have the Keter, but the Keter would not have it. This is a mistake. We have no doubt that the Rashi's Vav is, I don't know, I can use the word mistake. It may be preserves an older tradition. It's hard to know with these sort of things, whether we're looking at a mistake. When I say a mistake, I mean something that all the, that just a sofer made a mistake and then became popular, or we're dealing with something that went back, let's say, to Bai Cheney. On the other hand, we assume that there is one letter perfect Torah. So all the differences, even the ones that we say that preserve an older tradition, are also, in a sense, a mistake. But as we said last class, in the Beis HaMikdash, they would have three Sifrei Torah, which they would check against, and those were the expert ones. And even among those three Sifrei Torah, they didn't agree on everything, and they went by the majority. Why David K. Looker of Soloveitchik said in Shir regarding women being shochtin. Yeah, the Rav thought that was a srara, as I recall, that a woman couldn't be a shochet because of srara. As far as I know, he is the first one in history ever to say that, that argument, that it's srara. And in Italy, we have kabbalot. Women, they had to shecht because the men would leave. I don't know why I didn't have this problem in Europe. I guess the shochtim stayed in town, but we know that in Italy, you had small communities. Even you'd have, let's say, even three or four families of Jews in the town, and the men would be gone for the whole week. And so women would shecht, not the, what we call gasso, not the big cows, but they would shecht chickens. And we actually have examples in the Tshuvot of Rav Yitzchak de Lattis, who's going back hundreds of years. He has an example of a Kabbalah he gave to a woman that she could shecht. But the other sources speak of it in terms of minhag, that the woman doesn't shecht. There is Eldad Hadani, I think it's in the volume, in his tradition, he says that women don't shecht. And Tosus, I think, says also because we can't rely on them. You can, Rav Shneur Lyman has a piece on the Masorah of Chazal, the Gemara and Kiddushin. Yes, he has in his, it's in the Torsky, no, it's in the Festschrift for Moshe Greenberg, who was his teacher at University of Pennsylvania. It's called Mesorah versus Halacha, something like that, a study in conflict. This is related to what I said last class, that the Halacha, if you look in the Rashba, the Radbaz, they all say that if the Gemara derives a drasha from the way a word is spelled, and if the poskim say this is how it's spelled, that's how you spell it. The problem is that the Masoretes and the guild, which wrote the Sifrei Torah, they did not follow this. They went by the Masoretic tradition, which is in conflict with the Halachic tradition, and our Sifrei Torah are not in accord with the drashot that you'll find in the Gemara. They're not, our Sifrei Torah are not in accord with Halacha. They're in accord with the Masorah, and that's because the people who are in the Sifrei Torah followed the Masorah. They didn't follow what the Rashba said, that, and things like that. You can go, Shneur Lyman's articles are all on his website, Lyman Library. You can find that article, very, very nice article. Thank you, Shmuley. So he said that. Yes, Hyman points out the Gilui HaShas. Of course, it's a famous Gilui HaShas, where he points out all the places in Shas where the Gemara quotes the text of the Torah. Not just, most of those are actually not Torah, which differ from our Torah. Yes, and we have in Tosfos. I was asked privately which questions I asked to which rabbi. Often I ask the questions regarding, because I saw things in their books. Rabbi Greenblatt, I just general halakhic questions too. And some of them, a few of them, I just, Rav Henkin, I thought he would have an understanding of the college situation. And others, I just figured I wanted to create a relationship. I wanted to create a relationship with a certain rabbi because I found him interesting. So I just sent the question to him. And I wasn't even sending halakha l'maisa. I just wanted to know their opinion. No. Mutti Berger, says the Gemara in Erevin permits taking kulos from different rabbis if there's no tarte de satri. Yes, we will see Rav Ratzabi, who we'll get to next week. I ask this very question, can you take kulos from different rabbis? So we'll see what he said. I will be wary of using the text quoted in the Gemara due to the preponderance of copyists and printers' errors. Obviously, we have to be concerned about the text in the Gemara. we don't know. The oldest Gemara we have is medieval, but that's all we have. And we have, for example, Tosfot telling you on the spot that the Masorah differs. And we have Sifrei Torah from medieval times, and we have obviously the Dead Sea Scrolls. Shmuley says you can use diluted liquid soap even according to Ramosha. Okay, but that's not in the Tshuva. Ramosha's Talmidim also brush their teeth with toothpaste. No, Ramosha's Tal doesn't hold it. You can brush your teeth with toothpaste at all. Is that Rav Avadia sitting two over to the left of someone asks me, let me, Rav Yosef Messas? So let me see here. Let's see, is that a picture from, no, that's not Chacham Avad Yosef in that picture, no. Naftali says, to the best of my knowledge, toothpaste issue is the tube and squeezing it on Shabbos, which is tochen grinding. No, they also hold mamachek. There's other issues as well. Yeah, so thank you, David, mamachek. Brushing teeth. Well, the Rav held that, I think today, at least in the modern Orthodox world, brushing teeth is pretty standard. Rav Soloveitchik held that you could brush your teeth with toothpaste. Rav Abadi also holds you can. Okay, so Mitzvah had bad breath on Shabbos. Mouthwash. Rev Mati Berger says, or Yosef Masas was the Rebbe of Chief Rabbi Amar. Rev Shlomo Amar grew up in Haifa. His real Rebbe was Rabbi Yaakov Rosenthal, but he knew Rev Masas, and of course, as a Moroccan, he regarded him as a Rebbe as well, although he didn't study under him. He went to him, and he asked him questions, but Rabbi Rosenthal in particular. Rev Soloveitchik famously reacted to Ramosha's prohibition on brushing one's teeth on Shabbos. My cousin is wrong. Okay. Orach says, not everyone is equally generous in granting titles. Some are more restrained. Yes, some are more restrained. Professor Rabbi is... I think the Nefesh HaRav is more important work to Big Fatzon. Big Fatzon is Rav Schechter's independent ideas. Nefesh HaRav, I think, is important because it preserves so many of Rav Soloveitchik's ideas. Of course, it needs to be used carefully. I think it was Larry Kaplan who has a long review essay on it. You can't read Nefesh HaRav without seeing it writing through Rav Schechter. But that's the situation of Rav Soloveitchik. Every one of the Talmidim is going to present them a certain way, and there are certain things Rav Schechter tells you, kach shamati, I heard. Other things he heard personally. He's not just repeating stuff in the air. And I think it's a wonderful read, and I return to it again and again, and we'll wait till we get to another one of Rav Schechter's letters. You'll see something interesting. If you look at Art School's first citation, the Art School Gemara, to something that the Rav said, they describe him as Chief Rabbi of Boston, known for permitting toothpaste on Shabbos. They say that he was permitted. Okay, send that to me, please. I haven't seen. I haven't even heard that. Shmuley says in some communities, women don't fast. Yeah, well, I know. In many Hasidic communities, women don't fast, but I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, they don't fast on the other ones. But on Tisha B'Av, I believe they do generally. That's one area where the Dati Leumi is more stringent than the Hasidic world, in that they tell the women and even the girls to fast even on Tzom Gedalia. You know the old joke about Tzom Gedalia. Yeah, Gedalia wouldn't have fasted for me. Why should I fast for him? But that's even Tzom Gedalia, they tell. No Rosh Harav, okay. Does the Grov's ruling on the Shulchan Aruch apply also to the Ramah or just the Mechaber? Yes, everyone, both of them. It's the Shulchan Aruch means it means the Shulchan Aruch, it means the Ramah, the Mechaber. Baruch says that it's a good point that in Eastern Europe, people were weaker. Although I would only say to that people were stronger in the days of Reb Chaim than they were 300 years before. I don't know, for some reason, Reb Chaim had a hang-up. He thought that everyone was very close to dying, and no other posek felt that way. they didn't have potatoes 400 years before that. I mean, it was much harder to get good food. Mutti burger, the grub disagrees with Shulchan Aruch hundreds of times. Yes, the Rogatchover and the Rav Chiyak of Weinberg, he's disdain for the Ramal, yes. The Rogatchover never quotes the Shulchan Aruch, ever. Did Rav Moshe not follow the Shulchan Aruch? I don't know if there's any time specifically. And when you say not follow, someone who knows better will have to answer. When you say not follow the Shulchan Aruch, if you quote the Taz or the Shach, Rav Moshe uses the expression Balei Shulchan Aruch. So that they're also included. I don't know offhand any time where Rav Moshe on his own independently will go against the Shulchan Aruch, and that includes the, you know, the Shach, the Taz, Magen Avraham, etc. Hyman tells us that Schneer Hyman says that just because it's a forgery doesn't mean it's all bad Torah. Yeah, I mean, that was what Avad Yosef said, and he quotes what the Gemara says about Ben Sira. Those things, the Isbe Mal Yusa Darshinan Bey, that if there's good stuff in it, it's not canonized Ben Sira, but we can use it. But if that's going to be your argument, then Solomon Freehoff, wait till next week. Let's start using Solomon Freehoff, a Reform rabbi, but he has some good svaras there. Paul Shaviv, Saul Bronin found refuge and burial in London because his brother Solomon Hussein was the Rav of the Great Synagogue, effectively the chief rabbi. Exactly. Not only that, the father of Solomon Herschel had also, Paul, correct, had also been there, I believe, or the grandfather, I forget. They were all related. The uncle, I forgot, Tevelish. No, that wasn't the father, did he? Ritzi Hirschleven. The father of Shaul Berlin and Solomon Herschel was rabbi in London. Okay, so we're coming to the end. It seems the Marshal held that view. See his introduction to Shalom. Yeah, but the Marshal didn't hold the Shulchan Aruch. The Marshal lived at the same time period. The Marshal didn't believe in codification. The Marshal didn't believe in it. The brother of the Maharal, probably the Maharal as well. So the Marshal doesn't need to hold of it, but we're hundreds of years later. And Hyman points out, thank you, Mezuzah and Tefillin require Kasidron. Shmuley says that Hasidic women fast Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, they'll be more lenient on Tisha B'Av if you're ill, maybe, than the others. Thank you all. I'm very honored that there's so many Talmidei Chachamim and people who know all sorts of stuff, and it's hard for me to keep up with all of you, but I'm doing my best. All things are throwing in.
Doing a good job. Thank you very much. Okay. Yeah. Tomorror morning, Marty Lakshin, 11 a.m., Tamei HaMitzvot. I look forward to seeing you, everybody, and during the week. And thank you very much. It's a little late.
Let me just say one thing. For those, it might seem at certain parts a bit of like inside baseball here, especially with the questions. I mean, they're mentioning Lyman and the Marshal and this, and I'm responding. I do this in the questions, obviously, but in the discussion that I speak, I try to keep everyone, so even everyone, even if you don't have the same background, we can see what's going on. But make no mistake about it, we're trying to do stuff here at a fairly high level, and we're not going to get 10,000 people listening, because this is sort of more...
Nobody gets 10,000 people listening.
Okay. We're dealing with some high level stuff here, thank God. Okay, thank you all.